Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The life of a foreign correspondent may sound exciting or romantic. Living and working in a foreign capital, eating the food, experiencing the culture may seem like a vacation. And of course, there is the adrenaline rush of being in the center of history in the making. But what is that really like? Is it that at all? And what about the conflict, the danger, the tragedy? How do foreign correspondents cope with that? Sylvia Poggioli, Eleanor Beardsley, and Ruth Sherlock have been reporting from far-flung places for NPR for years. Poggioli is based in Rome, Beardsley in Paris, and Sherlock in Beirut. But their work has made them globetrotters, covering the good, the bad, the ugly, and helping us to understand what's happening in our world and our connection to it. Theirs is an occupation not many get to experience, but we'll do that vicariously through a conversation with the three of them to discover if mamas should let their babies grow up to be foreign correspondents. Sylvia Poggioli joins us this morning from Rome, where she is senior European correspondent for NPR, and where it's nighttime there, I think. Sylvia, nice to meet you. Thank you for being here. Good morning.
My pleasure.
Eleanor Beardsley has been reporting from France for NPR since 2004. Nice to have you with us as well.
Wonderful to be with you.
And Ruth Sherlock is an international correspondent covering the Middle East for NPR. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you so much.
Eleanor, although you're in France and have to speak French to talk to the people you cover, I want to begin with you because you're not from there. I can tell by your voice and your accent, you're not from France. Actually, you're from South Carolina. You have degrees both from Furman and from USC. Where did you grow up? And was being a foreign correspondent something that you aspired to be from a childhood on?
I wish I could say yes, but I grew up in Colombia. And actually being a journalist never crossed my mind until I was like in my 30s. And I think what led me to do what I'm doing is I'd been taken to Europe at a young age, at 8, and we lived in England a couple times, and I went to France, and I was very attracted to Europe, and I always wanted to come back. And I started taking French, and I said, one day I'll be fluent, and I want to travel to Europe. And, you know, it was always that attraction to France and French and just Europe in general. And I just kept pursuing that, and one thing led to another, and I was always choosing something to do with French. And, no, I never thought I would actually live here, but here I am.
I'm curious, when you speak French, do they tell you have a Southern accent?
People always ask that. No, but they know you have an Anglo accent, because Okay. Actually whether you're English or American, it's kind of the same Anglo twang.
Sylvia Poggioli, your name just trips off the tongue. It's like music. It's as all things Italian seem to be. You're the daughter of Italian anti-fascists who emigrated from Italy during the Mussolini regime, and you were born, of all places, in Providence, Rhode Island. I had no idea. I thought you had spent your entire life in Italy. What influence did either your parents' heritage or their experience fleeing from Mussolini's Italy have on you and what you do today?
Well, I think it gave me a tremendous interest in politics from a very young age, because my parents talked about it all the time. So I certainly was very much interested in current events. And obviously their experience has become, unfortunately, extremely useful to me now. And as you were mentioning before, how there is a tendency in Europe and in the United States of a tilt to the right, a political shift to the right in many, many countries, here in Europe in particular. And obviously some of the stories they told me, what it was like to live in a dictatorship, has been, you know, extremely important to me. I also covered the fall of communism covered the fall of the wall in Berlin, and then the Velvet Revolution in Prague. And I lived in Czechoslovakia for 2 years after the fall of communism. And I think that has also, that the sense of living in countries that have undergone dictatorships, it was very helpful to what my parents told me and what I learned from them.
We're going to come back to that later in this conversation, I hope. But Since you did witness the fall of communism and you've been in those countries, what is it about those countries and about fascism, that which is separate from communism, that you think Americans don't have a full grasp of understanding on?
Well, I read a quote the other day that I think it was Tom Wolfe said, we talk a lot about the danger of fascism, but it always happens in Europe, not here. I thought it was a very interesting statement. Certainly, you know, it's the nation state is still something rather recent in Europe. And, you know, with the exception perhaps of England and France, you know, the sense of democracy is still not a complete, it's not as solid a principle in much as it is in the United States. And so there's a political fragility in many of these countries. And of course, the problem has been exacerbated by this sudden surge of immigration from North Africa, from sub-Saharan Africa, from the Middle East. It happened very fast. And these are not countries that were born with immigration. They're mono-ethnic states historically. And there's been a great deal of difficulty for the average European in dealing with people who are not European.
Yeah. Ruth Sherlock is with us. She is based in Beirut. You've been living in, although you're not an American, you are, I take it from your accent, you're British. You've been living and working and covering one of the most volatile parts of the world for many years. And before we talk about those experiences, was this something that you felt compelled to become as a young reporter, a foreign correspondent? And given your personal interest and your focus on human rights reporting, is this work something that fulfills that aspect of your personality?
Yeah, I mean, I always, from university, I wanted to do a job that didn't require me being in an office. And I loved to travel, and I was fascinated by the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So I just went out to Jerusalem and started freelancing. And there's something so intoxicating and often difficult and captivating about this region that when you get here, it kind of sweeps you in. I was a freelancer. I moved across the border and reported on the war in Libya, and then moved to Beirut and started reporting on Syria. And you do see these awful things. As to your question about whether it fulfills that part of my interest, the focus on human rights, you know, it's frustrating because when you report from this region, human rights violations are just continuous every day, like on the most horrific scale. The Assad regime continues to do this, to imprison tens of thousands of people. But so it's not, you know, it continues to be sad to see, but I do think that there is always merit to highlighting these. If you can in some ways hold people to account for these actions, then, or, you know, indirectly, you know, hold the US to account for supporting certain leaders in this region who might, you know, commit human rights violations, then that has merit.
Being a foreign correspondent is not just death and tragedy, it's also culture and arts and other things. And I was interested to discover, Sylvia Poggioli, that you spent some time working with the Italian Spoleto Festival in Spoleto, Italy, which was started many years ago by the composer Giancarlo Monati, who then exported the festival to Charleston, South Carolina. Many people in our listening area have been to that festival. Fortunately, I covered the Spoleto Festival in Italy during one of its iterations and got to spend a lot of time with Giancarlo Monati. And I'm curious as to, it seemed to be very different than the American festival. And for an American, very unique, and unique doesn't need a qualifier, but it was unique. It was a unique experience for me. I'm wondering how that festival is viewed in the rest of Italy.
Well, I think now it is not, its heyday was really the 60s, the 70s, and maybe the 80s. Now there's so many festivals, so it's not as popular as, it's still going on, but it's not such a big event. But it was huge in the 60s because Menotti brought to Italy the most avant-garde theater from the United States or from other parts of Europe. He brought to Italy and the La Mama, I can't now remember all, but there were just tremendous I remember, I think Twyla Tharp, the first time I saw her, was also there. Grotowski, the Polish director, very, very avant-garde. And that was culturally huge. It was a huge revolution. And it brought so much of American art and theater and music to Europe that it was extremely important.
You're based in Rome. Eleanor, you're based in Paris, two of the greatest cities in the history of mankind, it seems to me. And you are a Francophile, as you've already mentioned, Eleanor, your lifelong passion for their culture and their language. You love reporting on the French, you say, because there are so many stereotypes about them in America, and you like to dispel those notions and show a different side to their character. What are those stereotypes, and what should they be?
Well, I find, I mean, this is probably good. People either love France and the French or they hate them. And so, but they're always interested. So when I first came to Paris, I was freelancing and, you know, I had come from Kosovo, another story, but I was trying to get a letter to be somebody's freelance backup. And everybody said, oh, no, we have a correspondent and a backup freelancer and a backup. And I was like, oh, gosh. But when I got here, I broke in and I found that everybody wants something from Paris. And it's just, I haven't stopped. The day I broke in, you know, when I first came here, I haven't stopped. So that being said, for example, it's the same. The French have these views about Americans. So we think in France that everybody cheats on their wife and their husband and that it's okay. And, you know, I remember during the DSK, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, you know, he was running for president, and when he had, you know, abuse the hotel maid in New York City, you know, everyone's like, yeah, but aren't all the French, that's okay with them? Like, no, not exactly. There's just so many things like that. You know, I'd say, you know, if you're a French woman, you would actually care if your husband cheated on you too, you know, just because you're French. I don't know. There's just so many, but not so many come to mind right now, but it's just fun to dispel things.
You're working in a part of the world that most Americans, no matter how closely we follow the news, find confusing, Ruth. Conflicts in the Middle East go back millennia. They've led to fighting that seems to never end. And because of 9/11, people in this country either have developed stereotypes or have given up trying to understand the people of that region. And you've seen these folks at their best and at their worst. How have you come to understand the region and its conflicts? And how would you explain that to us in 30 seconds or less?
Well, it's a region with very diverse countries and people in it, obviously. So it's very complicated to sum up in one. But, you know, it's people are people. So you do have to, I think what Eleanor was saying about dispelling the kind of common assumptions is something I find really fascinating and really important to try to do here. And so one thing I'd love to do from this region is to talk to people or reach and get interviews with people who you might not otherwise think are like the most savory characters to talk to. So I spent a long time talking with members of ISIS, the extremist group, or with Europeans in particular, sometimes like young girls that ended up joining ISIS in Syria. I started talking to them about their lives and why they do that. And I think, you know, that's fascinating because I think that by talking to these people, you're not giving a voice, you're rather understanding. I think it's important to understand the complexities of these regions and the controversies, because if you do that, then you have a better sense of figuring out how to solve these problems.
Ruth Sherlock is an international correspondent based in Beirut for NPR. She's here with Eleanor Beardsley from Paris and Silvia Poggiole from Rome. We're going to continue in a moment in Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Silvio Poggioli, who is the senior European correspondent for NPR from Rome. Eleanor Beardsley joins us from Paris. She's a correspondent there for NPR. And NPR has Ruth Sherlock to thank for many reports coming out of the Middle East. Ruth, you're not an American, but you're reporting regularly for an American audience. And this is going to be a question for all of you, because is there a particular way that you have to approach covering the news, writing the story, explaining the news for a part of the world that doesn't pay all that much attention?
I think there is. You're always looking out for stories that would resonate with an American audience, right? To try to reach across that divide. But I think you have to be careful of that to some extent. Like, you don't want to, you know, NPR's listeners and the listeners today, everybody are educated and interested, and they're listening because they're interested. So I think you have to not oversimplify. You rather just kind of explain the context of each individual story in as much detail as you can. It's difficult, but you have to do your best. And the thing is, at the end of the day, what captivates people, especially in radio, is individual stories, individual human stories. And I think those help a huge amount in like dispelling stereotypes and rumors. If you can get in and tell the story of like one, the life of one family, for example, there's a huge economic crisis going on in Lebanon at the moment, with spiraling inflation, and people have found their salaries shrink to nothing overnight. If you go and sit with one of those families and talk about what that means, the cost of baby milk now costs approximately a quarter of somebody's monthly salary, the teacher's salary. Those kind of factoids, I think, reach across that divide. So it's all about the detail.
Both for Eleanor and for Silvia, the news is the news. But sometimes we over here don't know what the important, because things are happening all the time, what the most important stories are. When you decide to pitch a story, or when you decide to go someplace to cover a story, how do you know that's the story? How do you know that's the story that NPR wants you to report on, or NPR thinks their listeners would be interested in? Silvia, I'll start with you.
Well, you know, it depends. I mean, obviously, if there's a breaking story that is happening, we're all covering it. Every medium in a place will jump on it, and it's obvious. Otherwise, it depends. You know, it's so completely, you never know. I pitch a story I think is great. Depends on the editor I pitch it to. Sometimes they totally agree, and sometimes they just totally don't agree. So I don't think there are any rules there. I've been pretty like, I haven't been turned down that many times for my pitches, but it does happen once in a while. And I just don't understand why.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Eleanor, if you've been turned down before, as Silvia has, do you sometimes turn out to be absolutely right and the editors who've turned you down end up regretting it?
Yes, it's happened. But I think both of these women would agree with me that when you get to know a country, you know what's interesting and you know what Americans are going to like, and they take what you want to report on. For example, you know, there was some regional elections in France recently, and that's very ho-hum boring, and nobody was really talking about them anywhere. But here, the far right was going very strong. So I pitched, I need to go down to this southern town where this guy could really win, and this could be a big sweep by Marine Le Pen, you know, the far right leader. And so, of course, nobody had heard about it, but they said, yeah, go, go. Of course, they didn't win. And so it fizzled out, and it was nothing, but it could have been something. So you get to know your country. You have to go with your instinct. I mean, everyone in France was talking about that. So I thought, well, that's the story to do right now. But sometimes you can do a quirky story. I mean, and you just see it with a different eye. Like, they have these street markets in Paris, like 250 a week. And afterwards, you know, they clean up with all these crazy, I mean, they you know, poopers, scoopers, and sprayers, and all of these machines that to me look like Dr. Seuss machines that I had never seen. And they put up these markets and sell, and it would, you know, all these food markets, and then come clean them up with these crazy stuff. And I'm like, my God, that's a story right there. And then you'd see young, you know, trash people were like young women who were mothers. I'm like, why are these women trash women? You know, apparently because having a job with the Paris, you know, trash department is a great job. You get six weeks vacation, salary, retirement. And then, so I did a whole story that nobody was doing on trash, and there's a trash school here. And it was, so it turned out to be interesting, but I saw that with a complete foreigner eye. So sometimes you can see things as a foreigner, and then sometimes you just go with the flow of what, you know, the French media is covering it for a reason. It's important. So you say, hey, we got to do this NPR.
Your job is to tell us about the rest of the world, but you all live in far-flung parts of the world. And I'm curious about what American, how America is viewed. We're getting some questions from people listening to this interview right now about how we are viewed in other parts of the world. How does the rest of the news, rest of the world, get their news about America? What are the sources aside from the BBC?
But they have their own channels here. There's tons of great French news channels, and I think they do a pretty good job.
Well, I was going to ask, do you find them to be accurate, to be fair? Do they understand what's going on?
I'd have to say they're doing a pretty good job. Yeah, sometimes no. It's gotten better, I think. You know, the world is getting smaller with, you know, everybody's getting news at the same time. So they're getting news from the same places we are, and they have correspondents also in the U.S. who are reporting from the U.S., and sometimes they have a better eye for things. And so I'm finding they're getting better and better. I used to become annoyed when I'd see things about the U.S. that seemed to me totally off or just obscure. But now I think it's better and better.
Yeah, the same in Italy. I'd say that the last four, call them tumultuous years in American politics, have been intensely covered here by the Italian print and TV media, and with quite in depth, and I think quite well, with some, you know, astonishment about what was happening, I should say, but essentially good journalism.
It's been interesting in the Middle East because, you know, there's a sense that America is the superpower here that has so much, a superpower that has so much influence in this region, you know, the legacy of the Iraq war, to mention just one. And so sometimes there's a sense here that America controls everything. But one thing I found interesting about people in this region's view of America was their positions on Trump. You know, Donald Trump was actually quite popular among people here who you might class sort of leftist liberals, because they were looking at it from a perspective of foreign policy. And, you know, of all the American presidents that have been in power during the 10-year Syrian civil war, actually it was the Trump administration that was the only one that took planes and bombed Damascus. So for people who you might consider kind of liberals who oppose, for example, the Syrian regime, that kind of changed. So it was a sort of inverted effect of people's opinions on Trump in the Middle East versus in the U.S.
I was going to ask you, Ruth, because we have such a tenuous and strained relationship with many countries in the Middle East. We just ended the longest war in American history in Afghanistan. We're bringing troops home, but we invaded Iraq, and that resulted in the toppling of the Saddam Hussein regime. We have virtually no relationship with Iran, while at the same time we have a very close relationship with Israel. How is all of that, these relationships that we have and how we have conducted ourselves, viewed by ordinary people on the street in those countries that you cover?
You know, the influence of these global politics are felt so keenly here. There is, as I mentioned, this economic crisis, a complete meltdown. There is no government. The government resigned after this huge explosion last August in at the port here that destroyed half of the capital city, well, devastated parts of the capital city. And everything is on hold. And you have this sense that every day the country is getting worse and worse. The public services have broken down. Driving around Beirut, there's no traffic lights, for example, at huge interchanges. There's no meds in pharmacies now. Hospitals are shutting down. This situation is critical, and the government has not yet been formed. Why has it not yet been formed? Well, apparently there's a lot of people who are waiting for the Iran-US negotiations to figure out whether or not there's going to be a US nuclear deal with Iran, and that will have a knock-on effect on Hezbollah, who is a proxy militia that Iran funds and has influence over here in Lebanon, who in turn has huge influence in the government here. So you can see how there's this kind of complicated interconnected web between U.S. policies and how they affect individuals on the street here.
We're getting some questions, as I said, from people listening to this conversation. One is, what does the average person on the street think about why America has so many guns and gun violence. I think we had over 100 people shot over the weekend here in the United States. No nationalized health care here. So much misinformation, which makes polarization worse. What are people saying about that? How do they view this? Sylvia, are we viewed as a dangerous place to visit?
I don't think people think so much it's dangerous to visit as just they're just dumbfounded by the possibility, the facility with which people can buy weapons and the benevolent attitude towards carrying guns in the United States. It's absolutely unheard of in Europe. You just don't hear about these masks. I mean, they happen once in a while, but they're incredibly, you know, rare. These mass killings, that happen in the United States constantly. Now, people just don't understand it. It's impossible for them to understand it. I don't think it frightens people to the point of not coming right now. Maybe COVID frightens everybody from not moving right now more than anything else.
But let's talk about COVID, because it was our impression over here as we struggled to get a handle on this virus that parts of Europe were doing it more quickly than we were and better than we were. But now things seem to be receding. I know that I think in France, didn't Macron declare that you have to have proof of vaccination to go out in public? Is that what's going on over there?
Almost. Tomorrow starts... Tomorrow, you have to have it to go to a movie, a play, a concert. And on August 1st, you have to have proof of vaccine or a negative test to go to a restaurant, a cafe, a bar. And they're just going to slowly squeeze people who do not get vaccinated. And there have been some protests against it, but I think the large majority of the French are now for it because we've been through this. We see the Delta variant. We saw what happened in India, you know, from France. And with regard to the U.S., we saw the U.S. turn around. I mean, the U.S. was a disaster zone under, you know, President Trump, and we saw Biden turn it all around. So now the U.S., you know, Europeans aren't allowed to go to the U.S. today. And that's upset a lot of people because, you know, people take vacation there. And so the U.S. has completely changed. It sort of just changes as these waves come. But it seems, I feel like people in France are learning, like, okay, we've been here before. We don't want to lock down again, so we're going to accept some restrictions.
What's the situation in Italy and the part of the world that you cover, Sylvia?
The government is there's now European Union-wide, there's this thing called the Green Pass, which is the proof of vaccination, which is you have it like an app on your phone. And the Italian government now is contemplating whether to follow the French lead and require it to enter restaurants and cafes. As of now, it's only for like stadiums and big events. What I sense is that there's something now is happening that's very similar here and in the United States, because about 50% of the population has been vaccinated here. But what's happening is now the right wing is being basically poo-pooing vaccination, saying, oh, they're not really necessary, especially for young people. There's now a question about whether all teachers and students should be vaccinated before the school starts again, because this remote learning has proved to be very, very negative. It has done, kids' grades have been very bad overall throughout the country. It's nobody wants to do the remote teaching anymore. It's been very, very negative. And a negative effect for both students and for teachers. And so now the debate is, now there was a right-wing politician saying, no, they're just saying vaccinations are not all that important. Young people don't need them. It's so similar to what's happening in the United States.
Where is that coming? We think we know in this country where that's coming from. We think it's coming from Tucker Carlson and others on Fox News and other right-wing news.
It's the same.
It's the same.
Anti-vaccine people, social media, and
What's the situation in the Middle East with availability of vaccine, the number of people being vaccinated, and the and whatever surges may be going on with the emergence of the Delta variant?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very different picture here because so few people have been vaccinated. So partly that's because of problems accessing the vaccine. You know, I've reported a story looking at how do you get vaccines into war zones. The logistics are actually very complicated. You know, with some vaccines, you like I think Pfizer, you need to have extremely cold chains of storage. And that's just really, really hard when you're driving. You have to drive on like war-torn roads for 5 days to get to a village to reach to get the vaccine distributed. That's a huge problem. But also vaccine skepticism. You know, I was talking to people in northern Syria, which is opposition held, not controlled by the government. And aid workers there, Syrian aid workers were telling me that in no way were they were not going to take this vaccine because they had seen, you know, AstraZeneca is the only vaccine available and they've seen reports of blood clots and there is nobody to counter that message. So a tiny percent of the population, I think, you know, it's as low as like 1 or 2% might have been vaccinated, which is, you know, an issue. The same here in Lebanon, there's a lot of vaccine hesitancy. So the government has been trying to have these vaccine drives where you no longer have to book an appointment, you can just show up and get vaccinated. But people aren't going, which is a great cause for concern because at the same time, you know, the Delta variant has started to arrive in this country. In many countries in this region, the governments themselves have handled this by trying to hide the pandemic. The Syrian regime, for example, was threatening doctors in Damascus who talked to media about how bad the situation was. They initially tried to cover it up. So at the moment, you know, it's summer, there has been a reduction in the number of cases, but we are seeing a start of another wave. And for these countries, which are in war and economic crisis, it's really a very difficult picture.
Yeah, there's a lot of misinformation about this going on over here and also over there. Clearly, Eleanor, you reported recently about a French television news program showing a comedy clip from Jimmy Kimmel's show, dealing with a spoof on vaccines, and they took it as serious, accurate, truthful.
I think that was in Beirut.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It was, you know, it was a funny clip. It said, you know, this holiday, this Valentine's Day, give your loved one what they want. And then they opened a ring box and inside there was a Pfizer vaccine. Pfizer. I spoke to the person who ran that clip on the MTV, the local TV channel here, and they said, honestly, it was embarrassing. It was a genuine mistake that a young producer had just started and saw this and thought this was fact, like thought that this was what Americans were giving. Like they thought this was, and apparently missed the canned laughter. But I'm not sure I fully buy that explanation because it's interesting that that TV show feeds into conspiracy theories about the coronavirus as well. So that was kind of one of a longer series of kind of strange claims about coronavirus.
Ruth Sherlock is based out of Beirut. Eleanor Beardsley from Paris. Silvia Poggioli in Rome. We're coming right back in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with Silvia Poggioli, who covers Rome and much of Europe and other parts of the world for NPR. She's their senior European correspondent. Eleanor Beardsley, also a correspondent from NPR from Paris. And Ruth Sherlock, an international correspondent based in Beirut for NPR. Your work can be, at times, dangerous. Ruth, your coverage of the Arab Spring was recognized by the British Press Awards as being astonishing, demonstrating skill as well as courage in producing what they described as harrowing accounts. You went undercover in Syria, in government-held areas at the height of that conflict. You were smuggled into the country by rebel fighters. We know that a lot of journalists have lost their lives doing this work. What makes it worth it for you?
You know, it's a really difficult calculation, especially now that I have a daughter. If you stop and try to rationalize this, it's very difficult. But I think the point is that you always think that it won't happen to you, and you take precautions to try to make sure that that's the case. On the flip side is that I think you said it at the beginning of this program, you are witnessing the making of history. You are right there when these dramatic events are unfolding, which is a privilege. And I think There are times when it's scary, there are times when it's dangerous, but paradoxically, in a conflict zone, you almost feel more in control because you are thinking, if you're on a front line, you are thinking in great detail about every single move. You're like, okay, am I okay to go and hide behind this wall, which is 10 meters away? Is the speed at which I can run here safe? You know, can I get there in time? These kind of calculations means that you're, because you're so aware of your environment, you sort of feel more in control. That might be an illusion, but you do, of course, take all the safety precautions you can to make sure that you can protect yourself, and you know, you just keep doing your job.
When soldiers go into an area, they at least have combat training, but you're going into combat zones, all three of you in many cases, and I'm just curious as to what in your background has prepared you for this. Who do you rely on? How do you keep yourself safe in some of these places? Sylvia Poggioli.
Well, first of all, I did not choose. I was covering a political story in what was once called Yugoslavia that then degenerated into war. I was sitting watching, covering an independence celebration when the whole country exploded, and sort of had to improvise myself along with many other reporters, my colleagues. I think the most, and then I covered for the next decade, I covered all the wars of Yugoslavia, and then finally also the NATO war on Serbia over Kosovo. And I think what you learn, first of all, is that you don't travel alone. You travel with another one or two other reporters. You have to be very trust. You have to totally trust the people you're working with. Sometimes also with a stringer or a fixer or a driver. You have to know these people. You have to trust them. You have to, you know, it's not something you improvise. You obviously, it takes, this happens over a period of time. I agree with Ruth, though, the sense of when you're in a danger zone, you want the story, but you have to protect yourself. You may have to make sure that you're going to be able to get the story. And that's the most important thing. And when I was covering the fall of Yugoslavia, there was none of this hostile environment training that they're doing now for you know, nobody even talked about post-traumatic stress. It didn't exist as a concept. And I can tell you that, you know, I got it. I had it usually when I went back home. When I went to Rome, I got more nervous crossing the street than I was when I was in Sarajevo under, you know, Serb sniper fire. But those are, and I found that many of my other colleagues had the same thing. And then all of a sudden it became sort of, everybody started talking about PST and post-traumatic stress and everything. But you have to learn how to deal with it. And if it's too much, you just should not be doing, you shouldn't be doing it anymore. And I think that unfortunately at times when there've been these wars, a lot of reporters have been pressured into covering the stories, which is really not the way it should be. Everybody should be doing this.
What about the logistics of doing all this? News breaks in a moment with a moment's notice, and you feel that you have to go there to cover it for whatever outlet you're working for. And I guess you have sources and contacts that you have developed over the years in some cases, but not all. And as you just said, Sylvia, you have to learn to trust people. You have to work with people you trust, drivers and translators and people like that. But you often go into these areas that have no infrastructure left because of war, no water, no power, no this, no that. How do you get accommodations? How do you get transportation? How do you feed yourself? How do you get the story back in situations like that? I'm not sure who to ask that question.
I can tell you that during Yugoslavia, there were no cell phones. We didn't even have our individual sat phones. So that was a huge problem. For instance, Sarajevo, during the siege, the BBC had set up a big satellite phone, and basically all the other, every medium would pay the BBC to be able to file their stories over their sat phones. At the time were huge. They took up half a room. And I'm talking about the past. There were no cell phones, you know, you right. Had no way of being in connect, no email at the time. So that was very difficult. But in terms about food, I can tell you that I used to fly into Sarajevo with a lot of cans of tuna. And that used to get me through for at least a little bit of a few days.
Tuna kept me going in Libya too. There was just tuna sandwiches. And really, really quickly to add to that, in Libya, when Misrata, this town, city Misrata, was under siege, and forces loyal to the then leader, Colonel Gaddafi, were firing artillery into the town. And, you know, it was amazing. We got a boat there and had no idea what to expect. I showed up on this boat with some Libyans who were going to fight and a couple of other journalists. And we were met at the port by just these locals that were so keen to show us what was actually happening. And it was it's a very incongruous experience being in these war zones, because there are so many things that are completely normal in a situation which is totally abnormal. So to give you one example, this guy picked us up from the port in a like white Honda Accord, and he was playing ABBA on the radio. And I mean, literally two rockets landed like within 100 meters of our car as we were driving to the location. It's this very warped world. You know, he took us to stay at somebody's house. So it's a very strange, incongruous scene.
The tragedies that you have to cover, and whether they're in a war zone or whether there's something that happens in Paris where people were killed in that theater, I believe it was several years ago, or at Charlie Hebdo, it has to take a toll on you. And in some places that you're covering these stories, you can leave, but the people directly impacted cannot. They live there. How do you deal with that psychologically?
It's very difficult. It's extremely difficult. In fact, I can say that precisely the wars that I covered, you know, the purpose of those wars was not the military strategy was not gaining a bridge or a fortress or anything. It was basically to attack civilians, to move them from one village to change territory. Unfortunately, the expression ethnic cleansing was coined in the Balkans more than 100 years ago, and that's exactly what the purpose is. So citizens, civilians were the victims and the targets. And so we basically, this is what we covered. We covered personal stories, and it's devastating. And then, of course, in the case of Bosnia, there was the case of the rapes. And that was an extremely difficult story to cover. There were many women reporters, and we mostly did those stories because it was very difficult for women, for male reporters to talk to these women. But, you know, it was extremely difficult. I think we can, one thing we were proud to say that thanks to much of that coverage, the UN Tribunal in The Hague made rape in the case in war a war crime. And it was after Bosnia, and I think that had something to do with the coverage that we did of that story. But it's excruciating, psychologically, and personally.
Ruth Sherlock, you've also covered what happens in these refugee camps, and there are lots of people living in refugee camps as they flee violence in various parts of the Middle East, and some of those refugees do eventually make it into Europe. I want to talk about the friction that is causing. But when you go into these refugee camps, some of which people have been in for years, the conditions are not ideal, probably deplorable in some cases. What do you say about the character of people who can go through that, laugh, because you report about people cooking dinner in these camps and laughing?
One thing you learn is that humans are so adaptable. The human is able to... I've seen people living in these situations that, like you say, you think, God, I could never do that. And you find that people find a way through, and they find a way to cope, and they find a way to find small moments of joy within that, whether it's taking pleasure from their kids. You know, they love their kids the same way that any family, any parent does, and that those children bring them joy. You know, but yeah, the resilience of people is something that... I am consistently stunned by. I've seen that again and again when I went to, for example, the city of Raqqa, which was devastated in a US-led coalition offensive to oust ISIS from the city. They got rid of ISIS, but they destroyed the entire city. And there's people, I just went there, you know, a couple of years ago, and I mean, literally people were going back to find no homes, like all their possessions, everything obliterated. And it's remarkable that now if you talk to people there, the city has started to spring back up. And that's not because of aid money, because that was cut, you know, foreign Western support has been cut. But it's because people do find a way to rebuild. But it is devastating. I agree with everything that Sylvia just said.
Eleanor, there, you know, this has caused a refugee problem across Europe with people flooding in certain countries. I don't know how affected Paris or France is, but it's causing some political problems in these countries. Are people in the European Union and governments in the European Union handling this crisis any better than America handles what's happening at its southern border?
Well, I would say they're not handling it in a uniform manner. And you have some, you know, and of course, countries like Greece and Italy are taking the brunt of the migrants coming. And, you know, Emmanuel Macron, French president, wanted to share and you know, the Western countries in Europe and the EU wanted to, you know, share the burden and sort of have quotas. But that was completely refused by the Eastern countries, you know, Hungary. I mean, I covered a lot of these. I covered all the migrants coming into Hungary when they took to the highway, literally on foot, to walk to Vienna because they were being. It was in 2015. I don't know if you remember, but they were the Hungarians were just there was that camera woman who tripped a father with his child, just and they were not letting them on trains, and they were just sitting in the middle of Budapest, and it was really stressful, and it felt it had this horrible feeling. Like, I remember they stopped this train full of people and it was burning hot and they just held them there and they were in the train, but they were scared to get off the train. And you really thought, my God, this feels like World War II. And this feels like the Nazis or something. It really felt like that. And I went to the home of a former prime minister in Hungary and he was hiding a Syrian family. He would take in Syrian families so that they could sleep, take a shower, and he'd serve them breakfast. And he'd have breakfast with them at his table with his wife. And he had a little baby. But they had to do this all, like, hide it because it was against the law. And it was, this was in Europe, the EU, but Orban's, you know, Hungary. And so it's a problem everywhere.
I have 2 minutes left. And I want to talk just a bit about this tilt to the right in Europe and around the world. It's happening here as well. And in America, some pundits on television will use these allusions to fascism. And since your parents, Sylvia, escaped fascist Italy in World War II, and since you're watching the rise of some of this in the European Union, are these comparisons to fascism then at all accurate?
I think Hungary's getting very close. You know, as you can't even say as long as they're free elections, because, you know, I mean, Hitler was elected. So, you know, what could you say? I mean, it's not the parallel. I mean, I think maybe Hungary and in Poland, they're moving very, very far. They're moving in that direction. Here in Italy, there was a scare 2 years ago, when there was a very right-wing government. Now it's a sort of centrist government, and it's not as that, there's not that danger. But currently, right now, the issues that are very much at stake here in Italy, as in Hungary, is the whole issue of gay rights. The Italian Senate is trying to pass a law against homophobia, and the right wing is just being devastated. Really, the opposition is very, very strong and they're obstructing it. And it's very similar to what's happening in Hungary, where there's a tremendous persecution of LGBTQ people, and in Poland also. I mean, no, these are not yet, fascism has not prevailed yet, but the fascistic tendencies, authoritarian tendencies in some countries are very strong and very worrisome.
I have 30 seconds left. From each of you, I want to hear what the most rewarding aspect of your job is, Sylvia.
I'm still curious. So despite after all these years, I like to learn new things, and this job is fantastic.
Eleanor.
I just sometimes I'm amazed by the people I meet and I'm not expecting. I went to get an x-ray the other day and the doctor starts telling me about how he was Jewish, hid from the Nazis in Normandy with a family during the war as a little boy. And you just hear these stories sometimes and it's amazing.
Ruth.
I mean, truth is stranger than fiction. And that's what's so great. You get to live this fascinating experience. You learn from people every day.
Ruth Sherlock is an international correspondent for NPR stationed in Beirut. Eleanor Beardsley, correspondent for NPR stationed in Paris. And Silvia Poggioli, the senior European correspondent for NPR stationed in Rome. Thank you all for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.